Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 13th, also known as the opening weekend of the pro football season. But we're going to talk a little bit about politics instead. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Yes, well, I mean, we got a big show today. We're going to have Stacey Evans, one of the top, you know, challenging our open seat candidates in the state. I think she's got a ton of momentum. We're going to talk to Stacey Evans here in a little while. And then in the second half of the show, I'm real excited, we've got Jennifer Reed, who co-founded the Indigo Report, a blog on South Carolina politics. We've had some other folks, including Andy Brack, talk to us about South Carolina politics. But it'd be exciting to see what Jennifer thinks, since South Carolina is like one of the hottest states on the political scene nationally. So we're going to talk to her, but we're going to lead off a little mayoral debate talk. I caught a bit of it because I was stuck in a bit of Atlanta traffic leaving the Georgia Dome, so I didn't see as much as I'd like. But, Catherine, you're an Atlanta resident. I know as a good citizen you probably watched every bit of that.
I did.
Give us your initial thoughts.
I forgot that it was on. I didn't watch
it. Oh, my word. Catherine, who are you going to vote for?
Terrible.
How are you going to vote for?
Well, I know who to vote. I've finally made it.
Okay. Well, we won't do any endorsements tonight.
No endorsements, but.
Okay. Well, Tim, you saw some of that. What did you think?
Yeah, actually, I watched the whole thing. It was very civil until toward the end because the moderator was simply asking questions, and the four candidates were just answering. Right toward the end, though, the moderator changed the format and allowed the candidates to ask a question of another candidate. Interestingly enough, three of the candidates, Norwood, Reed, and Spikes, all asked their question of borders. With Borders asking her question of Norwood. So it got a little spicy toward the end. Don't ask me to pick a winner. It's hard to say in a format like this where it's not a real debate. It did look to me like Norwood was a little bit nervous, giving some canned answers and stuff. The other candidates looked pretty well at ease. I was interested, and maybe y'all can explain this, why the three candidates asked their question of Lisa Borders.
Yeah, I think we'd have theories on that. I did see it. And one thing I just noticed as soon as I turned the debate on, Mary Norwood had on a red dress against a black curtain. Borders had a black dress on against a black curtain, and you almost lost her. The two gentlemen also had on dark suits, but, of course, they had white shirts and ties to kind of pick it up. I thought when you take a still shot of that and put that on the Atlanta Constitution or Creative Loafing, that is really not going to be a good photo image for Lisa Borders. Now, is that worth any votes? Maybe not. But I did notice that right off the bat. Now, my theory, and I'll let Catherine give hers, I think people see that they believe that Mary Norwood is going to be in the runoff, and so you kind of have to pull Lisa Borders out of that spot because right now she's second, although I think we've had polling data that shows she might not be second anymore, even though it's from one of the candidates. But I think they see they need to push her back down to take that other spot in the runoff, and that's why everybody – and then, of course, I guess Mary Norwood targets her because I guess being female, maybe she feels that she – is the candidate she'd least like to see in the runoff. That's why I think they may have talked with her. Catherine, what do you think?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what the questions were. Were they about? Were any of them about that memo?
Budget was the question that Spike can't ask.
Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons, probably. Well, number one would be that, you know, Lisa primary leadership position in the city council now for two terms. So, you know, maybe there's some accountability expectations. I mean, Mary Norwood's been on council too,
been
but
there too, yeah.
hasn't been in a leadership as much of a leadership position. There's that, and then I think there's a lot of people, especially the candidates, I would imagine, who are not particularly satisfied with her response to that memo about the, you know, racial makeup of the mayor's race. So it might be, I would imagine that those are things that might have. Plus, I think
Catherine, I was going to mention one thing they kept coming at Lisa Borders with was this deal where the mayor wanted a tax increase, I believe, of $1 million last year. She opposed it. And this year she is supporting like a $3 million tax increase. And they just kept hitting her with that, wondering why. And she was having a little bit of a problem answering that question. Didn't you think so, David?
Yes.
Well, I imagine that, you know, nobody wants to be in charge when taxes go up, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, now that they see what shape the budget's in, she probably realizes that they have no choice. And so, you know, but she should be able to say that, you know.
Yeah, it's
but
kind of
you
bad.
Hit on, you, I was just going to say you hit on something, Catherine, in that as president of the city council, she is something of a lightning rod more than the other candidates because she's viewed more as an insider.
Well, and she's you know, she's in an executive position, and she should be able to, you know, she has a little more accountability and responsibility for those budgetary issues and some of the other things. So I think that's probably part of the reason. It, certainly that's why I would think Mr. Spikes and Senator Reid would ask her questions. Mary Norwood is, I think we all have, you know, good explanations for why it went down that way. I think that Mary Norwood is probably thinking, well, you know, if I can get her numbers down some, then maybe there won't be a runoff.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order. But,
well, it is a tall order.
I do think
that Mary Norwood recognizes that she's in a better place if she's in a runoff with Mr. Spikes or Senator Reid than she is with.
Yeah, because I think actually a lot of times people focus on race, and it's like, you know, the white-black dynamic and a lot of issues, particularly now with this memo that came out a few weeks ago. But I think when people get to the ballot and they're voters that really don't have a clue about who's who, I think male-female dynamics come much more into play. You know, you've heard my theories on the Secretary of State's race back in 2006 on both sides. I thought that was a big deal where if you had a female name, that helped you. I think in Atlanta, you'd rather be the only female than one of two, just for those, you know, relatively uninformed voters that are just coming to vote and then just kind of pick a name. Because, you know the gender of a name a lot quicker in most cases than you know the race of a name.
Yeah. David, are you saying perhaps that gender could cost one of the females a spot in the runoff?
No, I think if you go and you say, hey, maybe there's some ladies that are going to want to vote for a lady because Shirley Franklin, you know, was in there. And where the memo said, oh, let's make sure the Atlanta mayoral spot stays black, maybe it'll be maybe the mayoral Atlanta spot stays female. And that may be, you know, some of the thinking. I mean, I don't know. I'm not there with that. I just found out something.
Well,
this, weekend.
I mean, we all know that it's much harder to go after women. You know, it would be much harder for, in a runoff, for a male to go up against a female because they can't be as aggressive.
Yeah,
I mean,
they can be,
but it doesn't work very well for them.
Yeah, the contrast is a little better if you're the female candidate, Mary Norwood. Have a male instead of a female. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think you could probably put pluses and minuses among any of the candidates and figure that out. Something I learned this weekend that I didn't know that I thought was interesting is the campaign manager for Mary Norwood's campaign is Roman Levitt, and he was actually John Barrow's campaign manager in chief of staff for a while. And do y'all know who his who the campaign manager was kind of at the times and then was the deputy chief of staff for John Barrow for several years. Any guesses?
Mm-mm.
Theron Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Who would be the campaign manager for Kasim Reed. I thought, wow, that's kind of, I mean, and of course, I've known Theron's been the campaign manager for quite a while for Kasim Reed. I just didn't know about Roman Levitt. I just found that kind of interesting. These two guys that worked together for probably 3 to 4 years are now facing off in such a clear way. Also, I thought something else was kind of interesting about that. I don't know who J.C. Spike's campaign manager is, but I know Lisa Borders and Kasim Reed both have African-American campaign managers, and Mary Norwood has a Caucasian campaign manager. You would think that given the diversity of Atlanta and what's going on with the racial memo, you would kind of think that one of those candidates would have crossed the line, if you will, that Mary Norwood by having an African-American campaign manager or one of the other two African-American candidates by having a white campaign manager. It shouldn't matter when, at the end of the day. I just still thought that was interesting that none of that happened.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine, you're close to the action. Certainly, a lot closer than we would be. What is your sense of where this race is going?
Well, I have to say that I think a lot of it is going to depend. I think we talked about this a little bit last week. I think a lot of it is going to depend on what happens when they go up on TV. I think that. I mean, obviously, Mary Norwood is leading in the polls, and if she has a strong television presence, I think that that will continue. I think Jesse Spikes is kind of. I just don't see him as having any much traction. People don't really know who he is. He's never run for office before, as far as I know. But I think Kasim, Senator Reed, and Lisa Borders are going to have to be very strategic in their advertising. I think I'm not sure what I mean by that, but I think that it's going to be very important that they have effective and well-executed television presence.
Now,
I think that can make a big difference.
David, let me turn to you with a question because you've worked in so many campaigns. When should these people hit television? Time is running short, isn't it?
Well, that kind of brings up my thought. Now, to me, I'm not so sure how much people should go up on television. I mean, they'll go up some, obviously, but how much should they go up on radio?
The reason
I say that is because, you know, radio, you can micro-target so much better. Because I know that if you look at, if you look at the average viewing audience of WSB News or, some program, My Name is Earl on Channel 11, Office, whatever you want to name, you're reaching so many voters outside the city limits. Whereas in radio, you can probably do a little better job for your money of targeting Atlanta city residents. Now, obviously, there's stations that you're going to get a ton of voters outside.
You can do that with television, with cable.
You can do it some. I mean, you can get more bang for your buck. I know, like, you can get, like, say, the 12 o'clock afternoon news, you reach a lot more older voters. Now, there's going to be older voters outside of
if you do it through,
cable.
Like, Comcast.
Yeah,
you
cable.
You can target cities.
Yeah, I mean that's the trick. You got to use cable then to target certain areas,
and that'll be
smart.
But back to my original question: When do you do it?
You'd have to look at how much money you have, how many points you want to put behind an ad, and that's how many times it's seen. And I know the theory was try to put as many points behind ads because you didn't have as many stations. Now I think you have to look at your polling data, see which voters you can move, and look at programs that those types of voters watch. I think you have to be far more sophisticated because you just aren't working with 3 or 4 channels like you used to be, where you could just raise a bunch of money, throw money behind that ad, and play it ad nauseum. I think you might like to do that at times, but you have to really look and see, what kind of voter watches what show, where can I put my money at. But then once you find a profile you like, I think if you have enough money to go now, go in 2 weeks, you better go or you're not going to make this runoff. other than Mary Norwood. I think she has the advantage of she can, you know, pretty safe getting in the runoff, even if she were second place, you know, starting to fall some. That's my thought.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you.
Yeah, so, I mean, and I don't know what kind of budgets they're looking at. See, that's another thing. You're running in an Atlanta mayoral race, but that's going to have, you know, one amount of dollars. But as far as television, the Atlanta mayoral race is about like running for governor. Because, I mean, sure, you can put, you know, ad money into Columbus and places like that, but they don't cost near as much as Atlanta.
Right, exactly.
Because that's half the voters in Georgia, or maybe more than that now. I believe already for our first guest, running for state house, Stacey Evans, and I guess Simple will still know you as Stacey Godfrey. Welcome, Stacey.
Thank you, David. Hey, Catherine and Tim.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Well, Stacey, you're running for office. Tell us exactly where the district's at.
The district is a little bit of Smyrna, a little bit of Marietta, and what I like to call a tiny piece of Vinings. It basically, for those somewhat familiar with Metro, it starts at the Galleria over by Cumberland Mall, go up Highway 41 to the Big Chicken, which I assume everybody knows who that is, turn down Roswell Street, and then come back down Atlanta Road. Now, there's little pockets here and there, but that's the basic gist of where the district is over here in Cobb County.
Yeah. Now you've been involved with politics for a while now, but what made you decide to seek this office at this time?
Well, you know, timing is everything in politics, and certainly I've been involved behind the scenes for a while and maybe had it in the back of my head that I would run someday, and I had just finished up a two-year term as chair of Georgia's Win List, which a little plug for Win List, Win stands for Women in Numbers, and it's a PAC that runs or that supports women who are running for statewide and legislative offices. But I had finished up that term at the beginning of the year and was sort of thinking about what my next thing would be that I would put my energy into, whether it be politics or community service or what have you. And it just so happened that Rob made his announcement that he was going to seek a higher office and run for attorney general. And so this seat became open. And so I decided that it was a good time to throw my hat in the ring. I've enjoyed working behind the scenes for a while and working with candidates, but at the end of the day, I really want to serve and I really want to bring the priorities of the citizens of Georgia and Cobb County to the legislature, and there's only so much you can do behind the scenes, so I was really excited about what I perceived to be perfect timing and an opportunity to jump in and run for the legislature.
Okay, well, you've given us pieces of your bio. Let's go ahead now, and you just tell us anything and everything you think folks ought to know about you as a person and candidate.
Anything and everything. Well, I grew up in Ringgold, Georgia, which is in the northwest corner of the state, just above or just below Chattanooga. And, you know, born and raised there, went to the University of Georgia for undergrad and law school. I'm proud to be the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I think that, more than anything, describes me or explains my motivation and what I do on a day-to-day basis, because I learned really early on with parents who hadn't gone to college. They, when I was growing up, worked in carpet mills, and I saw how hard it was on a day-to-day basis to, you know, to make ends meet. And I decided early on that I didn't want to struggle like that, and I was going to make education a top priority. And so I was really excited to go to the University of Georgia, and it was actually the only school I applied to. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't gotten in. But I didn't learn my lesson, because when I went to law school, that was the only law school I applied to either. So I guess I would have just had to find another career. But I did graduate from law school and joined the firm of, at the time, it was Powell Goldstein, Frazier & Murphy. We've since merged, and our new name is Brian Cave, Powell Goldstein. But it's been a great place for me because I've been able to obviously practice law, challenging cases all the time, but they've given me an amazing amount of flexibility and support for all the things that I've done in the community. Win List, as I mentioned, Red Clay and Young Democrats, both organizations that strive to bring young people into the political process and get folks moving at an early age. I've been really active with the high school mock trial program, which is a competition I did in high school, which I credit for making me a lawyer, where students get mock trial cases and they act them out and they play lawyers and they play witnesses. And so as soon as I graduated and started working, I got involved with that program as a as a judge, and then now I'm a chair of the state program. Those are just a few of the community organizations I've been involved in. I've always sort of geared toward or leaned toward organizations that affect policy and especially affect children, and especially as an example, WinList. I think I've always thought that electing more women would help bring education to the forefront for policy decisions. So there's a little bit. I don't know if it's anything and everything anybody would want to know, but I could keep going, but I'm going to stop.
Oh, that's not a bad description, and that's the kind of thing. We've been akin to this research of Drew Weston. People a lot of times vote on who you are, and many times as much as they vote on stands on the issues. So that's good stuff. I'm going to pass this thing over. Catherine, what are some questions you have for Stacy?
Hi, Stacy. Thank you for joining us this evening. We are always happy to have candidates on, and we appreciate taking time out of a Sunday night. We know how that's often family time.
Oh, well, I appreciate y'all inviting me to be on.
Excuse me. What issues do you think are going to be I have a twofold question.
Sure.
What issues seem to be important to the constituents that you'll be representing, and what issues do you think are going to be coming up in the legislature the first term that you would be serving?
Well, without a doubt, the top issues that I'm hearing about as I'm traveling around the district and talking to folks is education and transportation, without a doubt, the number one and two things people want to talk about. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, those issues haven't really been the top priorities of our legislature. As we saw in the last session, the transportation bill, it basically just died, and I think you're seeing a lot of frustration in that. And in Cobb County particularly, Cobb County is not hooked in to MARTA on the rail line. There are some bus routes that come up to Cumberland, but the business community is very upset because businesses will not locate up here because they want to tie into the airport. And until they can get that, they're not going to locate here, and Cobb County is not going to be able to really realize its full potential for growth and business and job development. And hopefully that issue will be taken care of in this next session, but if not, I think that will certainly be a hot-button issue again for the 2011 session, which would be the first one that I would participate in if I were fortunate enough to be elected next year in November. And education is always at the top of everybody's mind. We're failing our children right now, not just in Cobb County, but across the state, and we need to do something about it. We need to make education the priority, and people say, oh, education is so hard, and we're never going to get it. We're never going to fix it because it's just too hard, and you got to have parents. But at the end of the day, we can fix it if we make it the priority and if we focus on it and we talk to the teachers and we talk to the principals and we talk to the school board members about what do you actually need from your state government to do what you need to do in your district. And so that's one of the main things that I want to focus on. And again, it's one of those issues that I would love for there to be a solution before I ever get to the legislature, but unfortunately I think it's going to take more time than that. So I suspect that in 2011 we'll be grappling with educational issues as well as transportation.
Well, that sounds great. And you said you were spending some time in the district. What are you doing? Are you knocking on doors and all that stuff, or what's up?
We're not knocking on doors yet, but I am meeting with anyone who will meet with me. I've met with several folks, just teachers, principals, Kiwanis, Rotary, going to the chamber meetings, meeting with neighbors around where I live. I mean, just anybody who will give me a meeting, I'm taking it. And I'm finding that one meeting leads to another. Learning about one issue leads to learning about something else that I didn't know about. It's a very, very, very educational process for me, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
And how many voters are there in that district?
There are 17,000 registered voters. Unfortunately, the turnout in House District 40 is on the low end. It's the third lowest in the state, and I've been told, and looking at the numbers bears this out, that in the primary at least, which will be July next year, a turnout of 1,000 would probably be considered a good turnout for this district, which is really amazing. But hopefully I will be able to get out there and energize more people to come out and vote, not just for me, but just to come out and vote for other races that are on the ballot and really galvanize more people to get involved in the process. And one of the reasons I think that the vote is low, and this goes to my heart with my involvement in Red Clay and Young Democrats, is there's so many young people in this district. The majority of the district, the registered voters, are under 35, and they're not voting, and they should be voting. And I think if they did vote, obviously the primary wouldn't make much of a difference, but for the general, those are Democratic voters, and that would help us all across the ticket. And so we've got to now that I'm a candidate in this district, I have a responsibility to not only get out people to vote for me, but to also support the Democratic ticket. And I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen with voter registration efforts and just general get out the vote activities after the start of the year.
Great. Sounds good. I'm going to pass this off to Tim now.
Yes, ma'am. One issue I wanted to talk about is one that has been simmering for a while and now has exploded. Especially with the budget numbers that were released for August. So far, the state here has pretty much used budget cuts as the only means to try to balance the budget. But new revenue numbers, as I just mentioned, have shown that this really did not get the job done. If you get elected and you walk into the state legislature next year and the first thing you have to take up is this budget shortfall, what would you suggest to your fellow legislators need to be done?
That is a great question and one that I think we should have started asking ourselves a couple years ago. What are we going to do when everything doesn't turn out the way that we think it will? Because we shouldn't govern thinking that we're always going to have the best case scenario, because that's just not realistic. The first thing I would like to do is look at all of the budget numbers, both what are we spending money on and where are we getting our money. And I don't really feel educated enough at this point to say what I would recommend. It's something that I would want to study. And I'm sure that if people spent the time to look at those things and sort of predict in the future, what am I going to do if this happens, I think we would have an answer to that already.
Okay, and the other thing I wanted to ask you about was something you had already touched on, and that's the transportation issue. You can go up here to North Carolina, and you can go to Charlotte, and you can get on a train, a commuter train, and go to Raleigh. Park your car, go to Raleigh, do whatever you got to do, your business, whatever, come back. You can't get on a train in Atlanta and go to Macon. Are you a proponent of light rail? Do you think it's a good idea for Georgia?
I do. I absolutely do. And I think we need better transportation solutions within the city of Atlanta. There's obviously, especially during the work week, you get a mass of people that are in the city, and there's got to be a way to get in and around Atlanta. But we've got to connect the state to the rest of the state. And having grown up in Ringgold, I can tell you, I'm an hour and a half away from Atlanta. When you're in Ringgold, it's an hour and a half away. We never went to Atlanta. I mean, I remember I could probably count on one hand the number of times I went to Atlanta before I went to college, and most of that was probably school field trips to the zoo, maybe one Braves game. And that's not good. And I think the people that grew up in Macon or even further south may say the same thing. We've got to have ways where we're all able to travel to each other for all different reasons, for business, for education, for tourism, what have you. We definitely need to link. We need to link the state together much better than it is right now.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. David.
Yes. Well, Stacy, one kind of question that's a little bit policy, a little bit politics, is let's say you get in the legislature, win, which I personally think you will, but we still have the same makeup of the state house, state senate, and in the governor's mansion. It's Republican. And we still see some of the same results, which I don't think many people think are very good. But then people are still voting Republican. What do you think the Democratic Party is not doing in the state house, the Capitol, basically, to get that message across that, hey, we don't like how things are going in Georgia, it's the Republicans' fault, but the average Georgia voter, or at least those swing voters that make the difference, aren't blaming them for? How do we do to tell the story.
We've got to tell the story. We're not telling the story. And I think it's up to all of us, not only our elected officials, but also party leaders and constituents at large, to tell the story. And I think the legislators should be the Democratic legislators should lead that story. One thing I would like to do, because I think you're right, I hope we're able to switch the houses, but I think just being realistic, we're probably a couple more cycles away from that, is to come back into the district, hold press conferences, write letters to the editors, organize rallies and town hall meetings, not just every now and then, but as much as possible, and especially after you've seen something like this transportation bill, for example, die. There's no way the Republicans can blame the Democrats for that. They were in charge of both houses. They let that bill die. And the average citizen probably don't realize that that's what happened. And if we had come home and said, you know, you're sitting 45 minutes in your car to try to get to work, we could have fixed that. Here's why we didn't. Your Republican-controlled House and Senate let that die, and they're letting you sit in traffic. Just coming home, having the press conference, having the town hall meeting, writing the letters to the editor to get the word out in the old-fashioned grassroots way.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Back during the session, Virgil Flood, and I believe DeVos Porter put some effort behind it too, they had a proposal where we would have collected tax revenues a little differently. It wouldn't have been a tax increase in any way. It would just change the way taxes are collected. And basically, Mark Matheny, the communications director, came on and talked to us about it. It would have been millions of extra dollars of revenue for the state because the way it got collected would have been more streamlined. And it was this great proposal, Democratic proposal. It was, but it's one that the Republicans just shouldn't have been opposed to right off the bat because it didn't increase taxes. You know, I bet there's five people I know that actually know anything about that, and I'm on the phone right now on this radio show with two of them. But Catherine and Tim were told the same time I was. And it was just like, but that's the kind of thing. People, I mean, there's these proposals we have, but nobody seems to, you know, get out there with them. So I think people are trying to tell the story. There's just nobody listening to the story. And maybe that's the discussion of media, which, you know, you're not, as a running for state rep and as a lawyer, you're not the person to fix that or answer that. But I think it's going to be a tall order. So I hope we'll come in with some more energy, no matter who it is.
Absolutely. Well, and being involved in the districts and going to these Rotary and Kiwanis lunches and showing up at Chamber and just showing up at the local coffee shop, hardware store, and barber shop and just talking to whoever will listen to you, and that is not, I don't know, it's not extremely exciting, and it doesn't seem like it would be a way to get done, but once you start doing that enough, eventually somebody's gonna cover it, somebody's gonna get interested in it. And
well, but if you do it enough, you don't even need the media to do it. If the leadership in the districts, the state senators and state representatives are doing it on a regular basis, then, you know, sure, it'd be nice if the media pays attention, but if all of our districts are, if all the Democrats in all the districts are doing that, then you kind of have eliminated the necessity to get the media to do it. I'll give you the example of my state senator. I have written to her probably 6 or 7 times. I've faxed her letters. I've called and left messages. I've sent her emails, and I've never gotten a response from her. She's a Democrat. Never gotten one response. In the last 3 years that I've, you know, written to her about specific things that I was concerned about, questioning, you know, why a vote went a certain way, but I've never gotten a response. And that's me. You know, I'm an inside baseball person. You know, what about the person that, you know, doesn't even know how to do that?
Right. Well, and another thing too, during the campaign season, not all, but I would say a good number of folks, at least if they're running for the first, second, or third time, maybe not after they've been elected much more than that, but they walk the districts and they talk to their voters. And I think that's something that elected officials should be doing, not just at election time. And I know it's hard, and I'm finding out more and more exactly how hard it is to do everything that everybody wants you to do as a candidate. But at the same time, pick a couple streets you don't have to knock on every single door, but once you go out and you're talking to some voters, they're going to tell their friends, and they're going to tell their friends, and they're going to tell their friends, and you start this ball rolling down the hill where everybody starts to, it sounds like you're talking to everybody even if you're not.
Exactly.
And that would be another way for us to get out, hey, listen, I'm fighting hard for you down there. I want you to know that this transportation bill didn't pass. Let me give you the names of five of my colleagues, and maybe next session you could call them.
Right.
Certainly what we're learning from this healthcare debate is, call your senators, call your reps, but also call the other people too. I mean, you're a U.S. citizen and they are Congress, and the same analogy holds true in the legislature, I think.
Yeah, well, Stacy, in your case, it sounds like you need to knock on about three doors a night between now and July, and you're sad. I mean, you can take Christmas and a few other holidays off.
Oh, if only it were that easy.
Well, Stacy, seriously, if people have heard you and they like what they hear, how could they help you in your campaign?
The number one thing, unfortunately, is money. It takes money to run these campaigns, even strong grassroots campaigns. Folks could go to my website. It's www.stacyevans.org, and Stacy is with an EY. You can donate online there. You can sign up to volunteer. Most of our volunteer activities will start up over after the first of the year, but please, if you would like to help out, please go on the website and sign up to volunteer. The other thing you can do is if you live, work, play, or know people who do in House District 40, please tell them about me and introduce me to them, voters, leaders, everyone. Like I said, I'm meeting and greeting with anyone and everyone who will meet with me. So plug me in and I'll be there.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, thanks again, Stacy, for joining us on the Kudzu Vine, and we'll be watching you on the campaign trail.
Great. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Stacy.
Thanks, Stacy.
Yeah, well, it's good to see candidates getting that out there early. I think any candidate, when they decide they see a seat that they want to run for and serve in, you got to get out there quick and work hard like she's doing. So she's definitely following the playbook, although someone that's accomplished as Stacy is in politics already to this point, that's not surprising.
Right.
Yeah, Catherine, are you on the board on win list?
Are
a member of it in any way?
I attend some of their events, but no, I've never been that involved in WinList. I mean, I give them money from time to time, it's a great organization. It's just never, it's not the one. You know, I have other ones that I.
Yeah, I think it's one of the more effective organizations in Georgia politics. I know Stacy also mentioned Red Clay Dems, which I think they do a good job. Although I think Red Clay is very inside the perimeter centric, whereas WinList, I think, does a little better job of getting outside the perimeter and helping folks all across the state, be it Macon, Columbus, Valdosta, what have you.
Oh, they do a really good job. They have a good presence around the state, and they do those trainings, and it's a really dynamic group, and they have a lot of good, solid. They raise a lot of money, and they support a lot of women candidates, and yeah, that we would we benefit greatly from the work that they do, I think.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I am chomping at the bit to talk about some South Carolina politics. But we're going to wait until we get our expert here, because that is the state. But until then, let's kind of throw another state in there. I had heard some talk that in Louisiana that David Vitter, even though he's got the strong challenge of Charlie Malosaw, that President Obama, if you had to pick one state that he has real trouble with popularity ratings, it would be Louisiana. And that David Vitter is running. He's one of the few candidates that's actually directly running against the president, because we talked about, like in Alabama, they're running against Nancy Pelosi. But there, he's running directly against Barack Obama. Tim, are you surprised by that?
No, not at all. First of all, he wants to get the focus on something beside himself, if you know what I mean. And you do know exactly what I mean. I can hear Catherine laughing in the background. secondly, he can look at the same polls that we can look at. He has a strong opponent, David. Charlie Cook has said that you know, even with everything that's going on, he is vulnerable. Yeah, if I were advising Bitter, that's exactly what I'd do. I don't even know if I'd mention my opponent. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's the old tactic that Glenn Gray Davis used. I mean, you know, try to just talk about your opponent exclusively. Because honestly, if there was an up or down vote on David Vitter, I think he'd be voted down.
Yeah, he's got a 41%. He's got like a 41% approval rating down there. So he doesn't want the focus to be on David Vitter.
Exactly.
He wants the focus to be on anything except David Vitter. And Barack Obama, President Obama, is a convenient lightning rod, right?
I mean, I just, but you would think that that is kind of interesting that he's doing that because that is, like I said, one, I mean, most states you're not running against the president, maybe because it's a presidential office. Maybe it's because on a personal level, the president's very popular. Maybe not necessarily some political things in some states. But, you know, it's just surprising that he would do that, or it shows how desperate he is, or it's just a different tactic, and that's why I do think it's noteworthy. But I tell you what, I think it is just about time for us to get into something we've been getting into on our own here from Georgia, but we need to get some expert opinions. I'd like to welcome Jennifer Reed from the Indigo Report, Indigo Journal, a blog that covers South Carolina politics as well as any in the Palmetto State. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, as much as we want to get into issues, your blog just has kind of come on the scene, at least in our front view mirror recently. Tell us the history of that and what it's about.
Sure. Well, we started Indigo Journal about 10, 11 months ago now. We're a progressive political blog. We cover South Carolina politics from a Dem perspective, which is kind of new in South Carolina. We haven't had a real state political blog. So we wanted to create an online space where Democrats in South Carolina could, you know, do some online organizing as well as cover some Dem candidates and issues from our point of view. So,
Old. Yeah, well, I came across it a week or two ago on Swing State Project, and I immediately was like, we've got to get somebody from the Indigo Journal on. And it seems like you are the most vigorous poster, so we said we're going to go straight to Jennifer. But I tell you what, I just don't know if we're going to ask about Joe Wilson or Mark Sanford first, two of your more infamous political figures. So I'm going to pass it over to one of my co-hosts and let Tim make that decision. Tim?
Okay. Well, you know, I'm gonna save Wilson, and I'm gonna go to Governor Sanford.
Okay.
Obviously, there's been a growing chorus of calls for Governor Sanford to resign, and the growing chorus is coming from his own party. I want to ask you up front, because you're on the ground in South Carolina, can Governor Sanford survive this, or is he done?
Oh, goodness. I think a lot of that's going to depend on what the State Ethics Commission report finds in the next couple of weeks. Right now, we're waiting on a report from the Ethics Commission, which is investigating alleged abuses of travel from the governor's office. The AP did an investigation, and they found that he misused state aircraft for personal as well as political events and failed to report that. There's also an allegation that he misused state funds by upgrading some travel tickets from coach to business class. And so I think what most of the state leaders are waiting on right now is that report. Because right now, everything that he's done isn't necessarily illegal. You know, cheating on your wife is, you know, not a very nice thing to do, but it's not illegal. And so right now, the Speaker of the House, Bobby Harrell, who is a fellow Republican, has said that he's going to wait and see what that report finds. And I think if that report finds misdoings on the governor's half, then you're going to see increasing calls for the Speaker to call a special session of the House to possibly move forward on impeachment. But until that happens, it's kind of hard to say what they're going to do. I think there's not enough momentum here in the state to move forward with impeachment without that report right now. So,
you know, we're looking, you know, from out of the state, and we're looking in wonderment that this man has apparently dug his heels in. Let me ask you one more question about this. if it gets to the House and impeachment proceedings would begin, would the governor actually try to ride this out?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. The one thing you should know about Mark Sanford, and this is the one thing that the state Republicans know about him, which is why you see calls from them to have him resign. They know it's a politically safe thing to do because they know he will never leave. The one thing you need to know about Mark Sanford is he is incredibly stubborn. He is completely unfazed by public opinion, by political peer pressure. In fact, the more you dare him to do something, the more likely he is to do the opposite. He's that kind of character, and he has a long history of doing that in the state from the federal stimulus stance he took. He tried to take a stand against taking $700 million in education funds as part of the stimulus package, to routinely vetoing state budgets even though he knows it's pointless. This is very much in his character. So, yes, the only way Mark Sanford will leave South Carolina is by force, basically, impeachment. He will not leave of his own volition, and he will fight it. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you're saying, in essence, we should pop some popcorn and watch it.
Oh, yeah, the Sanford drama is only just beginning, yeah. It will continue, yeah.
And on that happy note, to have a little fun with Representative Wilson, I'm going to pass it over to Catherine.
Well, I just have to say that the other night when I was watching President Obama's awesome speech and I heard that outburst, I thought, oh, surely it's Jack Kingston from Georgia. But I have to admit that I was somewhat relieved that it wasn't for someone from Georgia. But, of course, we knew it was going to be someone from the South.
Yes.
And, of course, it's been the story of the week. I'm really more interested in hearing a little bit about Rob Miller, mm-hmm. and what his chances were prior to that outburst and what you think his chances are now.
Yeah, Rob has a really, really dynamic story. He's an Iraq War vet, former Marine Corps captain, who served two tours of duty in Iraq. Last year, he really burst onto the scene, got a lot of positive attention, definitely gave Wilson the biggest challenge he's seen so far. He came within 8 points of knocking off Wilson last year, which for a pretty GOP-leaning district was impressive. The problem he had last year was he ran out of money.
That's not going to be a problem this year.
Yeah, that's exactly. Last year he ran out of money. He had a very hard primary challenge and wasn't able to really buy a lot of ad time towards the end, which I think hurt him. And this year, of course, both he and Wilson have raised $1 million since the infamous July comment. So already money shouldn't be a problem for him moving forward. I think there was a recent poll that showed that if the election were held today, that he'd actually edge out Joe Wilson by 1 point. I think most of the voters here are pretty mortified on both sides of the aisle that Joe Wilson had that outburst. So I think that will help Miller heading into this year. It's still a long time off, and it's still an uphill battle for any Democrat here in the 2nd District, but he's definitely got an excellent shot at it now. He's got a lot of statewide name ID now because of the outburst, and he's certainly got the funding. So it
should
definitely be a competitive race.
And getting more funding
as
we go forward. Right? So, I mean, I know that the Indigo Journal, and by the way, I wrote Indigo Report on the blog for Democracy, but I corrected it after you came
out. Sorry.
I'm really sorry about that. Rob Miller, would you categorize him as a progressive, or is he more of a moderate Democrat, or
I would say he's a bit of a mix. I would say on fiscal issues, he's a bit more of a conservative Democrat. On fiscal as well as foreign policy issues, on the social, the healthcare, and education issues, I would definitely define him as progressive. So he's going to appeal a lot to, I think, moderate swing voters. He's also, we have a lot of military folks in this district, at least 5 bases that touch or are within the district. So that's going to be a huge advantage for him. But yeah, politically, he's a bit of a mixed bag.
Well, that's important.
I think that's a good thing. That's a good thing, though, in this district.
Yeah.
That's going to help him. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being on. I'm going to pass it off to David now. I'm sure he's got a bunch of questions about Joe Wilson.
And Jennifer, usually what happens is I steal all the good questions from a co-host. I decided to be a little more gracious tonight. But Joe Wilson, now, you know, you describe it as a pretty Republican district, and I saw it was just an 8-point win, which in mm-hmm. these political days, an 8-point win is really not a big win, given
yeah.
how Democratic or Republican most districts are. Joe Wilson probably had a little bit of unpopularity going in before he called the president a liar so tackily. What was their read on Joe Wilson, or what made him unpopular before this?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on in the district. The district is kind of an odd makeup. It starts in Columbia, in kind of the upscale neighborhoods of Columbia in the Midlands, and snakes all the way down to the coast and ending in Hilton Head Island. But in between, you have large area of very rural areas that have been hit hard by the economic downturn. So you have large parts of the district that are really struggling with jobs and the economy. And oddly enough, you actually have a very high number of uninsured folks. I think 27% of the people at the bottom end of the district don't have health insurance. So you have a lot of economic factors that are going on, which I think is generally not helping the incumbent. but also he's not known for being a real strong voice. He's always been kind of a backbencher. He's always been known more for his constituent services, not really known for his great policies. So he's just kind of one of those folks that always votes in lockstep with the party, but he's not somebody, you know, you see on the news every day like Lindsey Graham down here, if that makes any sense. So he's kind of low profile.
Yeah,
he's got a district that's hurting. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd recommend you go back to that status because it seems like
you're
it's pretty unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Well, I guess piggybacking then on the Sanford issue, an interesting figure out of this whole Sanford drama to me has been the First Lady, Miss
mm-hmm.
Sanford. And from afar,
oh, yeah.
I mean, we're
Jennifer,
all
I have
three
to warn
staunch.
You, David is like obsessed with her.
We're all three staunch Democrats. And all of us, we've talked about this before on the Kudzu Vine, we all kind of have a respect for her.
Yeah.
You know, how she's handled herself, and it sounds like if we, you know, talked issues with her, we wouldn't agree with her. But the way she's handled herself, is the average South Carolina voter, I mean, like, completely on her side, and do you think she has a future in politics if she wanted it?
Yes and yes. The interesting thing about Jenny Sanford, a lot of people don't agree with her. She's always been seen as a very strong force behind Mark Sanford. She was his first campaign manager when he ran for Congress. She's always been a really astute sounding board. And since she's gone away, moved out of the mansion, I think you really get a sense of just how much impact she had on Governor Sanford's political success. His messaging has been off. He's been fumbling in press conferences. And to Jenny Sanford's credit, she really was a strong, strong force in that administration and played a really vital role. And she's sorely missed, I would say. As for her political ambitions, I really am not sure. She says she wants to spend some time with her boys. She's got four young boys, so I would imagine that she's going to spend time with them the next couple of years. But I would definitely keep her on the radar when all this blows over and her boys get a little bit bigger. I wouldn't be surprised to see her run for office.
Yeah,
yeah.
She kind of reminds me of a Republican Hillary Clinton. She controls her man's life in every single way. But one that just seems to get her man in trouble. I see that kind of comparison there. Well, one more issue on the governor's race. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. We're probably not covering so many issues. But in the governor's race next time, there is a strong Democratic candidate, or at least a guy exploring it, Jim Rex, the mm-hmm. head of the education department over in South Carolina. One, you can tell us how he looks as far as a candidate, but two, tell me, it seems like the only Democrats that ever seem to have a real chance in South Carolina politics are the education commissioners, because I know Inez Tannenbaum was like the best Democratic candidate to come along since, I guess, Fritz Hollins, you know, on a statewide level.
Yes.
What is it about that office that propels Democrats?
I think it's the easiest for Democrats to win. The last couple of years, the state Democratic Party isn't as strong as it once was, and it's because of the weakness in the party, it's harder for many Democrats to win statewide elected office. But education has traditionally been an issue that even in this very conservative state that we've done well in, as Democrats. And so, like, for example, right now, Tim Rex is the only statewide elected Democratic candidate. So I think it shows a little bit of the party weakness over the last couple of years, as well as that's just been education's been an issue we've been able to do well at. As far as Jim Rex, he definitely enjoys the highest name ID of any of the candidates that have entered, although we have some really great, really great field of candidates this time around. You got Vincent Shaheen, who's another very strong candidate, a young guy, a reformer from the Midlands, as well as Mullins McLeod, a newcomer from Charleston, and Dwight Drake, who's a very well-known Columbia lawyer and insider. So we're going to have a tremendous field of candidates. I think the Democrats realize that with the Sanford scandal, this is probably going to be the best shot we have to take the governor's seat for several years. And Jim Rex, certainly of that gaggle of folks, has the highest name ID because of his current office. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 3 minutes left, Jennifer. Tell us if there's any political stories brewing in South Carolina that aren't on the national or at least the regional radar.
Oh, goodness.
Pick the best one. I can tell you've got more than one.
Well, speaking of Jim Rex, I'm pretty sure he's going to jump into the governor's race for sure this week. He's been dancing around, kind of toying with everybody, saying he's still thinking about it. He's having a meeting tonight with his family to discuss whether he's a go or not. And everybody I've talked to said that he is a definite go. So look for that announcement this week. That should be a big story. As far as Sanford, look for more drama. he has gone out and dared the AP and the South Carolina media to dig further. He's taken a very combative stance with the local reporters, so look for them to be doing more FOIA requests and digging deeper. And, oh, goodness knows what's going to come out of that. So it should be an interesting week or two in South Carolina still.
Well, Jennifer, I want to give you some real good news. You know, on Thursday night, Clemson came to Georgia Tech, and they had a loss. And yesterday, South Carolina came to Georgia, and they had a loss. But tonight, you came from South Carolina onto the Georgia-based kudzu vine, and you had a win.
Oh, thank you.
So you're doing your state proud, and keep doing them proud by writing on the Indigo Journal. And, of course, if you want to link to the kudzu vine and tell about being on, you do that anytime you want. We're going to have you back and talk more South Carolina politics in the months ahead.
Absolutely.
And we're going to put a link up on Blog for Democracy this week to Indigo Journal, too. So.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed reading the blog the last couple of days since I learned about it. So good work. We know how hard it is.
Yeah.
And we definitely want to have you back because I have a strong feeling there's going to be a few more things to talk about your state.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to it. Thank you all for having me.
Thanks, Jennifer.
I'm sure. Yeah, well, I mean, Jennifer's got plenty to write about. Any state that has brought the country, John C. Calhoun, Strom Thurmond, and now folks like Mark Sanford, Joe Wilson, you know she's going to have topics to write about. That means we're going to have topics to talk about.
Can I just say one more time, the GOP, the gift that keeps on giving.
Phil, you used to say that about one particular candidate. That started off with David Vitter.
It did.
But then it's expanded. It's like contagious. Forget the swine flu, the H1 virus. These jokers are just embroiled in scandal. I mean, and there are times we catch it, too. I mean, we had our guy up in Illinois. But it's just rampant up there with some of those characters. But it's been another good show. We had a lot of good guests, and I've had a great time. Next week, Tim, I believe you're going to be off at a work function.
Right.
And I'm supposed to have a pretty good special guest, not quite as good as Tim being here by any means. But and then we'll have some other topics to talk about. No telling what we'll have lined up. We got to start probably getting some more of these municipal candidates from Atlanta, and including mayoral candidates. So maybe, Catherine, you can help me work on some folks there.
I'll see what I can do about that.
Yeah, but this has been the Kudzu Vine for September 13th. Night.
Night, guys.
Good night.